First, editor Amy Herman offers a quick look at the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch. Then we chat with Dr. Tessa Cook about her editorial advising a not-so-fast response to the idea that AIs are the equal of human diagnosticians.
Hi, everyone. Our first story. The American Thoracic Society and the Infectious Diseases Society of America have together updated their guidelines on community-acquired pneumonia. Among the changes from the group's prior guidance, the recommendation for macrolide monotherapy for outpatients has been downgraded from a strong recommendation to a conditional one based on local resistance levels. Next, the CDC reports that the number of people who've developed lung injury after vaping has hit 1,080. The agency continues to recommend that people avoid vaping, particularly products that contain THC. Our next story is for all the omnivores out there. An international panel of nutrition experts, clinicians, and others suggests that adults can continue eating red meat at their current levels. The panel notes, however, that the recommendation is ranked as weak and is based on low certainty evidence. And in other guideline news, the BMJ's Rapid Recommendations Panel suggests that some adults aged 50 to 79 not undergo colorectal cancer screening. This applies to those with a 15-year risk for colorectal cancer below 3%. Like the red meat recommendation, this one is also ranked as weak. Next, the FDA says that its early tests have found unacceptable levels of NDMA in the drug ranitidine, which is sold under the brand name Zantac. NDMA is a probable human carcinogen. And finally, a new study finds that in patients with left main coronary disease, percutaneous coronary intervention, or PCI, and coronary artery bypass grafting, or CABG, yield similar outcomes in terms of major cardiovascular events. And that's it for this week. Stick around for Joe Elia's latest clinical conversation.
This week, we chat with Tessa Cook. She wrote an editorial in Lancet Digital Health about a research article in that journal. The research article concluded cautiously that deep learning or artificial intelligence is equivalent to healthcare professionals. Her editorial said, in effect, not so fast, and so she's here to discuss it with us. Dr. Cook is an assistant professor of radiology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is the director for the Penn Radiology Informatics Fellowship. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Cook.
Thank you, Joe.
We should start the conversation by listing a few facts about the study that's the focus of your editorial. It was a meta-analysis of a small number of studies identified from a large, much larger sample size, about 32,000 studies, comparing computer diagnosis with humans. Only a dozen or so of those thousands of studies compared diagnoses on the same patients.
Correct.
And the aim of the study was to derive a measure of diagnostic accuracy. And it came up with near identical measures of sensitivity and specificity for humans and AIs. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Okay. So your editorial disputes the idea that AIs, let's call them, are roughly equivalent to human diagnosticians. And that skepticism is based on a few factors, one of which is the ground truth. When you establish ground truth in a study like this, what is it that you're doing?
So with any new test that we try to evaluate or introduce, it's important to know that the test is coming to the same conclusion as perhaps the best equivalent test we have currently used in clinical practice. And that's true whether you're trying to figure out new ways of detecting something with imaging or with a blood test, or now in the case of AI and deep learning with this new technology. And so you have to know what the right answer is, so to speak, so that you know when the tool is coming up with the right answer or the wrong answer or how close it's getting to the right answer. And so that's where establishing ground truth becomes really important. But also, even aside from AI and deep learning, it's a hard thing to do in a lot of areas of medicine.
Yeah. So, for instance, if the human diagnosticians come up with the wrong ground truth, the wrong answer, then you feed that back into the machine learning algorithm. The machine becomes as dumb as the humans were about this diagnosis, correct?
So that's one aspect of it, certainly. The other challenging piece is, you know, sometimes there's this concept of, well, there's the concept of bias that comes into a lot of this, because, you know, when we practice medicine in the real world, oftentimes the results of one test inform what the next test is that you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, and not everybody gets the same slate of tests. You know, some patients may have more invasive interventions because they were indicated. Others may not because enough information was available, or you made a conclusion based on the information you had and they needed to be treated or whatever it is. But everybody doesn't have the same sets of evaluations so that you can compare apples to apples. And so then when you take this data and you try to feed it into a deep learning algorithm, you know, it becomes a little bit tricky because now you have all of this data retrospectively. Because we're not talking about prospectively evaluating these tools. So you have the complete set of data that now you give to the AI, whereas the human physician had to figure out how to get all of that data, and really is the reason that that data exists, because the decisions they made led to the tests that were ordered, led to the results that maybe led to the other tests. And so there's this temporal piece, at least for right now, that we're not capturing as we develop these tools.
Yeah, you say that in your editorial that the diagnostic process for the machine doesn't match the human one, in which new information can suddenly become available, right? Mm-hmm. As you were just saying. And you have this wonderful, phrase. It can suddenly appear in the middle of the process where, as you say, data are messy, elusive, and imperfect.
Yeah.
And that
is the world in which we practice medicine. Absolutely.
Yes. And it's contingent on so many things, like whether it's time to go to lunch. I mean, it could be a lot of things. And so these deep learning algorithms are just collecting data. And you hope that the next time it sees that data, it comes up with the same answer. Whether that's the right answer or the wrong answer is something that you're calling them out on and saying, well, we don't know.
Well, I should also say that it's not the author's fault. I mean, they took on something really ambitious, and, you know, the only information they had to work with was what the authors of these other papers that they included in the systematic review had provided them. So, I mean, you know, my hat's off to them. They tried to do something that was really not easy. And it's certainly not their fault that they only ended up with, you know, 14 papers ultimately that qualified for the meta-analysis. But it really, you know, they brought to light something very important, which is that there's a pretty broad spectrum of how people are publishing the results of this research. And actually a number of the authors of the Lancet Digital Health paper are also involved in efforts to try to standardize how we report these research endeavors, because again, you don't know if you're comparing apples to apples. I mean, it's really hard to make that conclusion, especially when, you know, they started out with the entire breadth of medicine and came down to 14 studies.
These weren't comparing studies of a single disease. These were Correct. Diseases spread across the whole spectrum of medicine. And so they didn't have much information. But you're right. Your editorial does not criticize them. You, along with the people who wrote this meta-analysis, together are criticizing the way that research is being conducted.
We're all criticizing ourselves, effectively, for the betterment of the science and for, you know, better care of our patients in the future. But it's an important thing to bring attention to now at the very early stages.
What have your colleagues or friends, other physicians, said to you about this, the whole question of, gee, you know, an AI is maybe replacing us one day?
You know, there was a lot of, well, who am I kidding, was, there still is a lot of hype around this. And being a radiologist, particularly in my specialty, you can't turn your head without seeing the next article about how the AI outperformed the radiologist for some task or another. But, you know, those headlines are very misleading, because when you actually start to read what the AI did and what outperformed actually means, you start to peel back the layers and get to the bottom of, okay, well, the performance was pretty good. I mean, not unlike the authors of this systematic review found, you know, the performance was pretty good in one very focused, narrow task, again, with all of the information retrospectively available. And whether that's, you know, and in some cases, actually, even worse, with none of the information available other than what the appearance of the image is. And as radiologists, we don't practice in a silo. I mean, sometimes we're not given the information that we need. But when we do have the information, we don't just rely on the imaging appearance. We rely on the information about the patient, on their prior imaging, on other testing that's been done, on how they're presenting on that particular day in the ER or in front, you know, in the office. So it's a holistic approach to the diagnosis. And as the authors pointed out, there were very, I think there were four instances in their systematic review where something other than just one specific piece of information was given as part of the AI evaluation.
So more than just the image was
Correct.
Given.
in a particular instance. But to answer your original question about, you know, I have no fear of being replaced. In fact, I'm really looking forward to the day that AI can do things that computers do really well that humans don't do so well. I am not built to search the EMR. That is not an efficient use of me as a human. I'm a board certified cardiovascular radiologist. That I am good at.
Uh-huh.
But I would love to be able to open up a case and have the medical record feed me everything that is relevant to what I am trying to evaluate in those images for that patient. Cardiovascular imaging again. Have they had an echo? What did it say? Have they had a cardiac cath? Why are we seeing them today? Is there some genetic component to this disease? Is there a family history? You know, what other evaluation have they had already? What is the question today? All of that sort of, you know, context-based information retrieval, computers are really good at that. The EMR should already do that.
Well, you mentioned in your editorial a physician being a radiologist actually being shown something and being told, well, I can't tell you anything else about this patient. I can't tell you whether there's any bleeding or, you know, there's hemoptysis, I think the word is. I can't tell you anything whether the patient is a fever, but I want you to tell me, Dr. Cook, is this showing pneumonia?
Mm-hmm.
and so you'd be at sea in a situation like that. I guess you could make a diagnosis if you had to, if there's no other information available, but it might not be a good diagnosis. Is that
I could provide a differential diagnosis. This imaging appearance could be this subset of things. There's this other subset of things that it's highly unlikely that it represents. But, you know, in the absence of additional information, which is so critical, you know, we all forget that imaging is just one component of the evaluation of the patient. There's the history, there's the physical exam, there's all the other laboratory testing that might be relevant in a particular situation. And so to just restrict ourselves to say, well, I have all this information about the patient, but I'm just going to give you this one piece and go do your job really well now with this one piece of information, it's a little bit unfair.
Maybe it's a lot unfair. When I was a little kid, I was a lab technician during my summers in college, and people would send down requests for various tests. And I remember very clearly the pathologist sitting behind his desk and saying, "Dr. So-and-so has been reading the New England Journal of Medicine again." So what he was saying was, I've never heard of this test before, and Dr. Billy has just heard about it, and so he's ordering it. It's an indication that physicians need as much information as they can possibly get from as many sources and then integrate it. I guess you can't order all tests available on somebody. I mean, that's very expensive for the system. But if you're still at sea on something, I guess you have to order what you think might be the right one.
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to order what makes sense for the patient. But, you know, to your point as far as the information, yeah, it's important to have as much information as you can realistically get about the patient to make the right diagnosis. But we're often faced with the opposite problem is there's so much information in the medical record. And how can you realistically find and consume all of it? First of all, find what of it is relevant and then consume all of it. And I think that's where AI has incredible potential to help us, is with that information retrieval. Because if I, you know, again, going back to the imaging example, if I get an imaging exam for a specific question, I would love to have an AI that knows all the other relevant pieces of information that would help me to answer that question. Right. I don't necessarily need an AI to go find the findings on the image for me, because that's my area of expertise. But my area of expertise is not searching the medical record.
It doesn't sound like much fun to do that.
It really isn't. You know, the running joke about the medical record is you're only 30 clicks away from anything.
Multiply that
by the number of patients over the course of a day, and that adds up to a lot of clicks.
I had never heard that before. are you hoping that your article, your comments, and the article on which it's commenting, are going to shine a light on the way forward for these kinds of?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope that the article and the comment really sort of underline how messy the space is right now. And by the space, I mean sort of the manner in which we're reporting these kinds of studies and conducting these kinds of studies. I alluded to the fact that even separate from AI, journals don't really publish negative results. In other words, you know, if there's a hypothesis and something didn't work, I think a lot of scientists and physicians don't even really try to send that to a journal, because they kind of throw their hands up and go, well, it didn't work. I guess we're going back to the drawing board. But perhaps there's a lesson to be learned there, and that information is missing. And it's not just in AI. It's through all of science. And I think more and more what we're also seeing is this emphasis, renewed emphasis on reproducible research, particularly when it comes to AI. Because, you know, in fact, one of my residents just sent me an email a couple of days ago. He put together an abstract for a meeting and done some really nice, again, AI-related work. And I said, oh, this is great. You know, send the abstract in, but you really should write this paper. And he responds and he says, I've been scooped. And he sends me a link to something similar. And I said, well, this is a great opportunity to show that this is reproducible work.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you both sort of came to similar conclusions at the same time. Why not put it out there and say, look, this is, you know, this is actually showing that it could be a viable solution. So I think there's really a need for more and more of that, and for us to really think as we write our papers on AI work to give the reading audience enough information to really judge the work on its merits and you know, not try to sort of cut corners or hide areas where we think it might be deficient.
It's worth, I think, quoting the conclusion of your editorial. And so I'll quote it at length, and it starts, claiming equivalence or superiority of AI over humans could be premature. Perhaps the better conclusion is that in the narrow public body of work comparing AI with human physicians, AI is no worse than humans, but the data are sparse and it might be too soon to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you would stand by that. And this really is not a conversation about are AIs better than humans, but how are we going to get them to help us out, maybe?
Exactly. And how are we really going to evaluate these tools? You know, in imaging and certainly in the other image producing specialties, you know, there's been a lot of success in ophthalmology, more and more in cardiology, pathology, dermatology. So, you know, radiology is not alone here. It is really going to be important to have a way of evaluating the performance of these tools in a sort of methodical and standardized way, because every day there's another one out there. And, you know, for us, we are the consumers of these, but we also have to be the responsible consumers, because if we're going to start using these tools to care for our patients, we need to know what they're doing, what they're not doing, where they may falter. There have been a couple of examples in the literature showing that, you know, perhaps when the AI gets it wrong, it gets it wrong in a subtle way that, you know, the physician may not pick up on, and what is the impact on the patient as a result of that. So it's really sort of a call to action for, you know, all of us as physicians to get more involved in this process, regardless of specialty, and make sure that, you know, we know this technology has incredible potential, but just like with any other new tool or new test, we need to use it responsibly.
Well, Dr. Cook, I want to thank you very much for discussing your editorial with me today.
Thank you so much, Joe.
That was our 236th episode. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.